all about, girls. All right, what's happening?
I've been to the limit one time in my life. It took Linda Carter and Bo Derek back to back to make Ric Flair even.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
The whole world looks at me. Dallas, Tampa, Charlotte, Greensboro, Tokyo, Melbourne. I am your champion. Learn to like it. I am Space Monk.
I'm styling and profiling.
Kids stealing, wheeling, dealing. Limousine riding, jet flying, son of a gun. Woo, woo, woo.
I'm gonna pivot here onto a different, completely different area, but I'm sure it connects to all this, because, I was thrilled to see you write about Bill Cooper in the Chaos Conundrum, because you would not believe how I still get emails from people all the time about Bill Cooper, especially, there's a lot to talk about here. One thing is just that he seems to be a real, we talked about how it's hard for people to get into all this, or they don't know really where to start and that kind of thing. He seems to be an amazing entry point for so many people into this whole realm of weirdness that I still emails and messages from people who are like, what do you think of Behold the Pale Horus, or I read Behold the Pale Horus, it just gets dropped all the time, especially from people who are just getting into this, and we never really, I'm sure we've talked about him on the show, but never at any sort of depth, so it would be good to get him on the record in a sense.
He was amazing. I disagree with him about a wide variety of things, and I think he was a deeply shady character. Just the amount of stuff that was clearly lifted and repurposed from other people floating around that bulletin board system, BBS, pre-internet scene back in, 87, 88, 89, 90 or so.
Right.
I mean, a lot of his stuff was just straight lifted from Val Valerian's Matrix documents and the Krill document and John Lear's stuff. Which, he sort of explained by saying, well, I know this stuff is true because I saw it back in the 60s when I was working in naval intelligence. Which is, one of those things that you can say all day and have no way to prove one way or the other.
Right.
But at the same time, nobody can prove you didn't see it, right? So you can sort of pull that, proving a negative fallacy on them and say, well, you can't prove I didn't see these documents back in the 1960s. But what was great about Bill Cooper is that, I mean, great in an impressive way, not great in a I love the man and wish he had been my spiritual mentor or anything, is that he would constantly reinvent himself. That was the reason why he could stay around as long as he did, is he did this transition from the UFO field to the right-wing militia zone. I'm trying to find, and still doing some research, trying to find the point at which he changes, trying to find that sort of crossover point.
Yeah.
Because it's very, very subtle. If you go to his Hour of the Time website, and for those of you who don't know, Bill Cooper's dead. But that was a little blunt. Bill Cooper was shot by, was killed in a shootout with law enforcement officers after he shot a sheriff's deputy in the head back in 2001. And if you look around the web, he was, of course, clearly the target of a hit by, the secret government because of what he knew. No, he was clearly one of these tax protesters who made threatening statements and went and got into a shootout with cops. He had an ignoble end, unless you're one of his people. And then he was, a martyr to the cause of liberty or whatever.
But, exactly. Yeah.
But if you go to his website, a lot of it is still there. And one of the most recent things they've done in the last year or so is they have made every one of his shortwave and regular satellite radio, back not XM Sirius satellite radio, I mean giant 8-foot satellite dish in your backyard radio programs from back in the 90s available as very low bandwidth MP3s. I mean, you can get the entire, it's like over 1,000, like 1,400 hour-long shows, and it only takes up like a gig and a half of space.
Oh, wow.
Or something like that. But I got to tell you, the meta tags on them are terrible. So if you download them all at once using like a download manager or something, you're going to get a whole bunch of unidentifiable files. So be warned. But it's all there. And he goes from having, he's interviewing Brad Steiger. I mean, Brad Steiger,
oh, wow.
You know, grandfather of paranormal ghost UFO stuff. He was writing about this stuff, you know, in books that were, you know, popular books. I mean, you find them on the paperback spinner racks at supermarkets back in the day. You know, Brad Steiger was not some sort of obscure weirdo. Brad Steiger was one of the great popularizers of a lot of these stories.
Yeah, it's icon.
Sort of like Frank Edwards back in the 60s with his Flying Saucers on, you know, Here and Now books. You know, he was a guy who wrote a lot of books, and these are books that you would find in garage sales all throughout the 80s and 90s. You know, you go to almost any Goodwill store, Salvation Army, any sort of thrift store today, you look at the paperbacks, I would bet you will find a Brad Steiger book somewhere. Because these things were everywhere. And Bill Cooper was interviewing this guy. And then, almost seamlessly, he transitions into the UFOs and the UFO research community, you know, a front for the New World Order, for this political and economic conspiracy that's going to take away our freedom. It's a distraction. They're going to use the UFOs as a manufactured threat to bring about a one world government. And that became his thing as he became more enmeshed in the political conspiracy theory world.
Yeah.
And especially the militia movement. And actually, what I found is, and this isn't, I don't think it's any sort of groundbreaking thing, but it's one of those things where if you look at the dates of some stuff, you can see almost exactly when he makes the switch, and it's in 1994. And the reason is, there was a writer, I bring him up in Extraterrestrials and the American Zeitgeist, in some of the dark conspiracy theory stuff that I talk about from the 90s, but there was a guy, a Canadian journalist named Serge Monast, mm-hmm. And he was a Quebecois, so I'm probably like butchering however his name's pronounced, but I'm a Midwesterner, so his name was Serge Monast or something.
Yeah.
And gotta put my Indiana twang in there. And he was the one who popularized the notion of Project Blue Beam. Have you heard of Project Blue Beam?
Of course, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Project Blue Beam. You know, the holographic technology that is going to create this, you know, basically what Cooper said. You know, an image of flying saucers that will be used to deceive people into accepting some sort of world dictatorship to fight the aliens, right? The thing is, Cooper starts talking about this, as far as I can tell, from all I've been able to find, he starts talking about this after Serge Monast's Project Blue Book stuff has become sort of known on the internet. So, once again, in the mid-90s, just as Cooper's entree into the UFO world was the result of him sort of appropriating other people's stories, his exit from the UFO world and his transition to his sort of a post-UFO conspiracy life was also appropriated from other people's work and other people's ideas. Talent borrows, genius steals, you know, but
yeah.
at some point, he's got sort of a Shia LaBeouf style plagiarism thing going on, where you know, little thing that might make a little more sense today than it will when people hear this. But you know, I hate Shia LaBeouf, but
he's a douche.
Yeah, I want him to go. But you know, Bill Cooper is remarkably influential because he did put a lot of this stuff out there. And behold a pale horse, I don't know how he managed this, but still, today, 2014, I go into my Barnes & Noble here in Flint, Michigan, and I'm pretty sure there is a copy of Behold a Pale Horse sitting there in the paranormal section of Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, it's stunningly popular. It's just stunning. It really is. Like I said, I hear from people all the time. Like people I went to high school with, it'll be one of the few books that they actually know about and can reference. It's amazing that it's lasted so long.
Yeah, and if you look at it, and I think I bring this out in Chaos Conundrum, if you sit down and look at it, I haven't done an actual statistical analysis of it, but there's a healthy proportion of that book that was not written by Cooper at all.
Mm.
It's a compiling of a large number of other things, and if my cord will stretch, can grab it off my paranormal bookshelf of shame here in my office, and all the books I really shouldn't own.
You know what it's reminiscent of is like the the cliche of like the conspiracy person with all the stuff on their walls that connect with the string. It's kind of like it's a book version of that almost.
Speaking of conspiracy and esoteric stereotypes, when I interviewed here at Mott Community College back in 2006, after I got the job, my dean told me, she told me that when they saw on my CV the title of my master's thesis was about flying saucers, they figured I was some sort of weirdo. And there's some indication that they interviewed me almost to see if I was as weird as they thought I was. And they were all going to be, their plan was to all be wearing tinfoil hats when I walked in the interview room. And I'm like, that would have been awesome. You really should have done that. And they're like, well, we didn't know, you know, somebody might have been very, very offended by it. And I'm like, yeah, but. And then they probably would have sued you. But, you know, I would have thought it was really amusing. But
yeah.
As I sit here looking through my well-worn copy of Behold a Pale Horse, which I bought used so Cooper wouldn't get any money off me, there's his foreword that he wrote, and there's his Majestic 12 stuff that is basically expansions of what he had already published online. But then you get to the second half of the book, and he's got a proposed model of a new constitution that some think tank came up with. He puts that in here. There is a copy of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which, you know, giant red flag right there. He says it's not about Jews. It's about the Illuminati. It's all, you know, big cover-up. But still, it's the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which, so... He has this in here, and it's not even typeset in the same font as the rest of the book. It's basically almost like a Xerox copy of some old book of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. There's another couple chapters of letters back and forth between people that aren't Cooper, that he has, sort of like some, this guy sent me this thing. And it's printed in here. It's like, it's a dot matrix printer. And it's sort of photocopied onto here. And the whole second half of the book, almost 250 pages or so, is just a compilation of weird things that Cooper thinks verify his story.
Yeah.
But it all has this sort of patina of looking like something that somebody dug out of a file somewhere. That's been delivered to your house. And I sort of talk about this in the Chaos Conundrum, that what really always struck me about Behold a Pale Horse is, even though I know objectively that him putting top secret at the bottom of every page doesn't mean it's a top secret document, it feels like something secret.
Yeah.
It feels like something forbidden. It feels like special knowledge. And even some copies of a dot matrix printer with addresses and names redacted to protect them with, you know, margin notes handwritten. You know, yes, you know, objectively I look at this and I'm like, this is the cheesiest dang thing I've ever seen. But at the same time, it's just fascinating from a design standpoint. You know, it looks haphazard, but it's very calculated. You will never, ever, ever catch me saying that Bill Cooper was an idiot. This guy was bright. And this guy was a master showman and a master presenter of information. If you listen to his radio program, the guy has a great speaking voice. The guy uses emotion and tone and anger. And frustration about whatever he's upset about on that particular day in just an amazing way. And he's got a great radio voice, and he draws you in almost against your will. When I did research, a dirty little secret here, when I did research, it was, some of it was listening to Bill Cooper MP3s on my iPod while I mowed the lawn, you know. So, you know, I'm mowing the lawn and I'm listening to this stuff. Not good for your ears, kids. Don't follow my example, but, I should have been wearing some sort of industrial earmuff or something, but I wasn't. I was listening to things too loud. But I'd be listening to this stuff, and I'm just like, yeah, yeah, yeah. The income tax is designed to steal from us and to enrich the central bankers. And then I'm like, wait, why am I nodding? Why am I nodding? I don't know. Wait. And I'd catch myself doing that, which some people would say, well, you're a gullible moron, Gullius. But, you know, no, I think he was very good at drawing people in. And you know, he kept himself on the air for almost 10 years, from 93 or so to about, well, 2001 when he died. He had this, you know, he was running conferences. He sold these books. As he said, this book was a huge seller. And it seems like people who you wouldn't expect to have it.
Right.
And have read it and aren't sure whether they believe it or not, or which parts to believe and which parts to disbelieve, which I think is very telling. Most frightening thing of experience of my life with this book was when I was a dirt poor, and I'm not ashamed to admit this, dirt poor graduate student in Indianapolis. I was as many of us do, selling my blood plasma one day downtown. And while I can't believe how casually I just said that, I was selling my blood plasma one day, and I had my copy of Behold a Pale Horse with me. And you want to meet people with some interesting ideas about things, you walk around a blood plasma donation center with a copy of Behold a Pale Horse at 6 in the morning. And you will meet some interesting people who've had some interesting experiences. And I've decided if I ever get bored and I need to meet some interesting people, I should just walk around any sort of urban downtown area holding a copy of Behold a Pale Horse. And people will come up to you. I've looked through it at bookstores just to see if there have been any changes over the years. And people will come up and say, have you read that?
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think about it? It's just one of these... one of these touchstones of the 90s that's really, for as important a book as it was, is very, very sort of little known outside of our little circle of weirdness here. If you were to talk to a literature professor or historian of, you know, late 20th century, and you say, what do you think about Bill Cooper's Behold a Pale Horse? You'd be like, what? What is that? And, you know, but you say something like Roswell or the X-Files and they jump right on that. But one of the documents that, you know, was sort of a foundational text for some of that is less well known.
Yeah, I'd like to know the numbers on how many copies actually got sold, because it's got to be, I bet it would be a stunning number.
It would be. It would be. And as somebody who can't get it, whose wife told me can't get a new TV until he has book royalties to pay for it, a very frustrating number of books sold.
yeah.
Because, man, I mean, I wrote my whole book and I need to buy a TV. But, yeah, so it is, a very, very sort of interesting thing. And what's interesting now is that the, his Hour of the Time website, or his disciples, and I think that's an okay term to use for them, his disciples' website is, you can actually, I think, download it for free now, which I don't think has probably hurt the sales any. There is a Kindle edition available. It's got 4 stars with 424 reviews on Amazon, which is astonishing. There's an audio book on Audible. There's an audio CD. I mean, this is a going concern, and it would not surprise me if this is still making people a lot of money. It's number 2 in ranked right now in political social sciences, government ideologies under the radicalism category. It's number 2. Number 37 in astronomy and space science books. Think about that.
That's
it's
insane.
Number 37 in astronomy and space science.
And it was what? Written like 20 years ago, probably?
Yeah, December of 91. So,
over 20 years,
21, 22 years ago.
Jeez.
It's ranked 7,000th, which is pretty high. I mean, out of all the books that Amazon sells, that's pretty high. So, this has been a remarkably strong seller. And the fact that it's still available and people are buying it in all these formats when most of the contents are available free on the internet, what that tells me is that not only is it a very popular book and a very successful book, but it's a book that very much exists for most of those readers in a little vacuum of, this is a book by a guy. Not, this is a book by a guy who had all of this other stuff going on and existed in this whole other context, but this is just a book by a guy. Because I don't think there's a lot, and I'm speculating, I don't think there's a lot of crossover between people who buy this book in Barnes & Noble or Amazon and people who frequent the militia, freeman, sovereign citizen conspiracy theory circles that Cooper inhabited toward the end of his life, or even the wider UFO world. I think the book is very much a gateway drug in a lot of ways, but also maybe a standalone phenomena as well. Mm. Especially since Cooper, you know, renounced a lot of the UFO things, claiming that he was disinformed. But you notice he didn't tell people not to buy the book, right? So, you know, he said, yes, I was duped, and I was wrong about that. If you go to the website or you Google all one word Majesty 12, it's his sort of constantly sort of revised manifesto about what he thinks about all this stuff, including a whole lot of stuff about how Art Bell is clearly, you know, part of this massive cover-up, which I always found amusing because I don't think Art Bell is deeply involved in more than anything than in making more money for Art Bell, which is, you know, fabulous. That's what he should be doing. He's a masterful entertainer. Hmm. But yeah, it's Bill Cooper is endlessly fascinating to me, and I'm working on a new book right now that I'm going back to some Bill Cooper stuff. So
nice.
It's deeply frightening, but his background. it's actually a book for a academic publisher's series on science fiction television. So I'm looking at conspiracy theory and paranormal TV in the 1990s. So The X-Files, Millennium, Dark Skies, Harsh Realm, First Wave, that entire genre of stuff, and sort of placing it in its historical context with the conspiracy theory and UFO stuff that was going on at the time, which means I'm watching a lot of bad TV these days. So, yeah.
Interesting. But that sounds intriguing.
That's my lot in life. Yeah. It should be fun to write. So I'm in the very, very early stages of it, but you know, I'm still in the tracking down TV shows on eBay phase. So.
This is an amazing conversation in a lot of ways, because I forgot at several points throughout the last hour and a half that there will be people listening. You know.
Yeah, I know.
Good,
I know.
A good. That's a sign of a good conversation, good show, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I did notice that you didn't mention my friend Bigfoot much in the book, so what's your take on all that? I'm intrigued by your thoughts.
My take on Bigfoot is I am not nearly enough of an expert in that sort of thing to offer an opinion beyond that it is a topic, a field that is full of very, very bright, intelligent, hardworking researchers like Lauren Coleman. And a whole lot of scam artists. I think that there's a lot of scam artists, and that's what hurts it. When I think Bigfoot, what I think of is Tom Biscardi. If that was that his name, Tom Biscardi?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Back in 2004, 2005, you know, calling up George Norrie, I've got Bigfoot in a cage in the back of the truck, you know, that whole thing. I might be exaggerating, but I think it was pretty much along those lines. He had one. It was, you know, it was literally in the bag.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was this whole thing that sort of petered out as being a massive, massive scam. And, that was back when I listened to Coast to Coast before I sort of faded out from it. And you know, I think the Bigfoot thing is like I said earlier, out of all of these fields, I think cryptozoology has the easiest job because these creatures are either there or they aren't.
Right. Yeah. I've thought that too myself. Yeah.
It's a question of catching them and testing them and proving to non-enthusiast actual, you know, scientists who will need to be convinced, right? That these creatures are something new and different, or something very old and different. And I don't have any trouble imagining that, yeah, you know, if somebody were to find, you know, a creature who was significantly different enough to be, quote, unknown or hidden or lost, and sufficiently like the stories of what people have seen as Bigfoot or any of those creatures, it would be easy to convince me with the right proof.
Yeah.
Much more so than alien visitors or ghosts. I think maybe this is a weird thing to say, and maybe this is an indication of just, you know, how weird I am, or how weird a lot of this stuff is. I almost put cryptozoology in a different category because it's just not weird enough. You know, it's in the same category as Atlantis, or as Troy was before Schliemann's archaeologists found the ruins of Troy. It's like the Trojan War. It's a long talked about thing that might not be there, and eventually somebody will either find it or they won't. But until there is a successful conclusion to the story, and until something is found, it's going to be open to speculation, and unfortunately, it's going to be open to scammers. But the great thing about Bigfoot is, or cryptozoology in general, is that the scams are honestly pretty easy to debunk. Either this is a creature that is unknown to science, or it's something that, no, we have one of those, and genetically it's one of these, even if it looks a little funny.
Yeah, it seems like it's the one paranormal genre that is, that could make the leap into actual science, or it's like,
yeah.
I feel like if they ever caught the Bigfoot, or if they ever proved the existence of Bigfoot, cryptozoology would be folded into mainstream science. And I don't think that's going to happen with ghosts or UFOs or anything like that.
Yeah, or at the very least, what would happen is that particular discovery of that particular creature would be, like you said, folded into the biology and anatomy or whatever, depending on how primate it was, what kind of primate it was, the anthropology of these things. And then cryptozoology as a fringe area would continue looking for other creatures, other mythical creatures, you know, looking for the Kraken, looking for, I don't even know what they're looking for.
Firebirds
or something.
I've thought about that too. I think I asked Lauren Coleman about this, but I forget precisely his answer, but it's like, I worry for cryptozoology also, that if they ever do prove the Bigfoot's existence, then they lose like their main, they lose the Hulk Hogan of cryptozoology. So
right. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. You know, once Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster, either one of those, if either one of those are proven conclusively to be something or other, then it's gonna go from being something that everybody has heard of, whether they know it or not, like Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster, to something that is probably ranking somewhere below research into orgone technology on the list of paranormal things that the public has any clue about. Which is because, you know, there's only so many mysterious creatures that resonate with the public, and they're the ones that have gotten all the press. I hate the way I sort of keep going back to this as a market-driven phenomenon, but isn't everything these days?
It is. Believe me. That's the way I look at a lot of this stuff too. It's a show in a way. It's kind of
it is
hard to really look at it any other way if you're being honest, if you're being intellectually honest.
Yeah. And honestly, what we might call mainstream scholarship isn't much different. Only it's aimed at other scholars. If you look at the conference programs for any of the conferences of the big, you know, historical associations or political science associations or the modern language association that does all the language and literature stuff, what you'll see are trends in research and trends in writing. They're things that come and go in and out of fashion, just like all these other things. And people tend to pitch their research in directions that are marketable because they have to go out on the job market, or they have to publish this article or that book to get a job or to get tenure or to remain employed in some way. So, you know, everything is driven by supply and demand. And I don't mean that in a sort of, you know, libertarian, you know, free market thing, but, you know, people, if nobody wants it, not a lot of people are going to do it. And I think cryptozoologically, you know, what sells are the things that the proven commodities, like Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster. We can stretch it to, you know, your Ogopogos or your Yetis, but generally it's those Hulk Hogan type attractions. You solve enough of these mysteries and you're left with whatever cryptozoology's Dolph Ziggler is, and nobody wants that. So, or Damian Sandow.
There you go.
So, you know, you have these things that, yes, to an enthusiast, you know, yes, I will watch a Dolph Ziggler match any day of the week, you know, good worker. But, you know, you're not gonna sell the PPV, the pay-per-view with that guy, you know?
Exactly. So it's a double-edged sword, for the for the crypto community. But like I said, you were right that if they found the Bigfoot, he would get adopted by zoology. Like we said, they would lose their Hulk Hogan, but I think that it would be good for cryptozoology maybe in the long run, because at least it would no longer be dismissed. It would be hard to dismiss the idea that there are creatures out there that we haven't found yet. I don't see why that's such a hard thing for the mainstream to understand, but it still is people don't take it seriously, but they find creatures all the time. So I don't know.
Yeah. The thing is that the creatures they're finding aren't the creatures that cryptozoologists tend to be looking for. Cryptozoologists are dismissed as crackpots. But, you know, look, we found a different species of this, that, or the other rodent. That sort of indicates that, yes, there are things out there that haven't been categorized or that have been miscategorized or that have been thought to be extinct that really aren't. Because, you know, for all of our technology and everything, the world is still a pretty darn big place with a lot of places that we haven't explored. We haven't explored thoroughly. We might have mapped them. We might have, you know, surveyed them, but that doesn't mean that we've turned the scientists loose on them to catalog every, you know, plant and animal and planimal that might be out there. Planimal, I'm not sure that's a thing, but, you know, we haven't categorized all these things yet. So, but yeah, you find something cool, but it's not Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster. So clearly those things are something to be laughed at, right? You know, it's just, you know, I think the laughter factor is sadder and harder to justify in cryptozoology and any of these other fields. You know, I've no problem sharing in the laughter at some of the flying saucer theories out there. But, you know, when you have a guy like Lauren Coleman, who's done a lot, and others like him who've done a lot of good work about this stuff, and people just sort of dismiss the whole field, I'm just like, look, this is probably the least far-fetched of any of this stuff, you know, but
right.
I think we've, you know, you and I have done it in this conversation. We've lumped cryptozoology in with the paranormal, and having your big media outlets also be the big media outlets of paranormal stuff, that has an effect too, but you go where the audience is. The American Zoological Association isn't going to pay attention to your Bigfoot talk. So you have to go where the audience is. But then that's this sort of vicious feedback loop here of, you know, you're preaching to the choir, and your choir is nuts. Or the perception is that your choir is nuts.
Hmm.
And so you're nuts for preaching to them. So basically the uber skeptics will dismiss anybody they want for any reason they want because they can. And without solid evidence, it's hard to fight back. But I think cryptozoology has the best chance of any of these.
Absolutely, yeah. Especially because it's like, unlike UFOs and ghosts, it's draped over animals. We know animals are real, so it has the foundation is real. We just don't know how it's all going to pan out.
Exactly, it's not like, you know, ghost hunting is looking for a kind of ghost that's different from all the other ghosts that science accepts, right?
Exactly.
You know, but you know, we're looking for a primate, or we're looking for a lake dwelling reptile or amphibian of some sort. You know, we know about lake dwelling amphibians. We know about primates. These are actual things, and there just might be some out there that have escaped categorization and have, you know, sort of lurked on the edges of things for a while. I don't think that's crazy. I don't think that's crazy.
I'm in agreement there. Now you say you were kind of burned out on contactees, but I do want to ask you, you've done a lot of research into this. We've never done a proper show on contactees. Maybe I will do one down the line. I just came up with a cool idea. Would be have you and Nick together on to do a contactee show.
Oh, yeah. I love his book. I love his contactee book. I think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it would be cool to do like a double expert kind of thing. But my question for you, and I'm sure I've asked this, I may have even asked it of Nick, or I may have asked it of I think maybe I asked Bud Hopkins, but I don't recall specifically. But the question is, and it's always sort of vexed me, and that is just why things changed from contactees to abductees. There's still people who claim they're contactees, I presume. I mean, there are people who are making crazy claims nowadays. It's insane You know, there are people that claim outright that they're hybrids or that they're the claims have gotten even more outlandish and insane. But if we're looking at it from a historical perspective, it's interesting that there was the contactee era, then the abductee era, and there was this what happened there? What was the tipping point that changed all that and why?
There's a few things. And the way I sort of have conceptualized it, and I didn't really do this in Extraterrestrials in the American Zeitgeist, available on Kindle at an affordable price. Cheap plug there.
Yeah, good man.
I avoided abductions completely in that book because that's a quagmire that you just don't want to get into.
Right.
Because you start talking about abductions and all of a sudden, unlike contactees, there is a vast amount of scholarly material about abductions, particularly psychology and sociology and cultural studies stuff. And I didn't want to deal with it. The book would have been twice as long just to explain why I wasn't talking about abductions. So I just said, I'm not talking about abductions. But because you're not the first one to have asked that, you know, what caused the big changeover? I don't think it was a changeover as much as it was an eclipse.
Okay. Yeah.
The contactees fade out for a number of reasons. One is that many of their claims are not easily provable, and in some cases are easily conclusively disprovable, particularly their photographs. So when Jim Moseley and his compatriots in Nexus and Saucer News in the 1950s published an expose of Adamski where they talked to people who knew him and were willing to come forward and say unequivocally these photographs were made from some light bulbs and a hubcap, that knocks the stuffing out of the contactees as far as the rest of the ufological world goes.
Yeah.
Or the saucer world. They're fakes, they're frauds, we're going to paint them all with this brush, and we're going to move on to the next thing, which seems to be the Kehoe, NICAP, we're gathering data sort of thing. But then, so the contactees fade out. And I think another thing that causes the contactees to fade out, and this sort of came to me as sort of a bizarre sort of intuition thing. So it came to me so suddenly when I was on the air with Greg Bishop a few months ago that I worry that I actually read it somewhere and forgot I read it, but it seems to make so much sense. The contactees begin to fade out just as the African-American civil rights movement starts to pick up.
Hmm.
And so you have people in the contactees, and this is the sort of working hypothesis and theory that I'm going with these guys from a historical point of view, is that in a time of ideological and cultural repression during the 1950s, when there was a certain way that people were expected to think and act, especially about the government, especially about foreign policy, to speak out against war or in favor of peace, to speak out against nuclear armament, to speak out against this attitude of arrogance and hostility towards our enemies around the world, could be seen as suspect. But if you're saying it within the context that it's a message from the Space Brothers, you don't escape all scrutiny, as Nick Redfern has investigated and pointed out. Guys like Adamski did get visits from the FBI. But guys like Adamski were visited by the FBI and then kind of dismissed as a crackpot or a fraudster or a hoaxer or somebody who it wasn't their job to worry about because he's not really a communist. He's just
a lunatic.
He's just a lunatic. Yeah, so it was sort of a useful cloak. Now, that's not to say that many of the contactees didn't believe that they had experiences and didn't believe what these experiences were, but especially in the case of Adamski, one of the things I've done is I've gone back to his writings earlier in the 1940s and in the 1930s, and a lot of his philosophical ideas are the same. It's just by the 50s, he's added flying saucers to them. So there's a consistency in Adamski's ideas about brotherhood and things like that, that the flying saucers were added to either as a sort of deflection against people who might be suspicious of his ideological bent, because believe me, it is way, way, way easier to be vaguely leftish leaning in the 1930s than it is in the late 1940s and 1950s. Communist Party was at its peak in the 1930s. So saying things in the 1930s that were very much focused on peace and global brotherhood, there were a lot of people doing that. But in the 1950s, it was mostly people who were under some sort of political scrutiny who were doing it. And so the flying saucer thing for Adamski might have added to that sort of deflection, but it also was a way to market it, right? Everything, you know, comes down to finding an audience, and
yeah.
Flying saucers were big. So Adamski takes his ideas and attaches flying saucers to them, gets his message of love and fellowship and brotherhood out to a larger number of people. Now, as far as the transition from contactees to abductees, I think the contactees fade from prominence among the general ufological public and really fade from prominence among the general public by the early 1960s, especially after Adamski dies. He was very much the figurehead of this movement, and other guys like Van Tassel, George Hunt Williamson, George King kept going with his Etheria Society. It's going today. I follow them on Facebook. The Etheria Society is still there. But is that
the place in there's a place in San Diego that I forget the name of it now. Greg Bishop took me to it. I forget the name.
Los Angeles or San Diego or one of those places is their big headquarters, and they've got branch offices all over the country. There's one down the road in suburban Detroit that I keep meaning to go to, but I just don't really want to. That's fine. But yeah, that is the same Etheria Society that contactee George King founded back in the 50s. But then you get the rise of this sort of we're tracking the sightings and that are being covered up by the Air Force, Project Blue Book, NICAP sort of motif. And then the abductee thing appears to emerge. And if you're taking the sort of bird's eye view of the sort of shape of this UFO narrative, that's the way it looks, right? You get contactees, then abductees. But there's a sort of intermediate period where you have a whole bunch of different types of encounters between people and some type of alleged alien visitor that don't fit into either the contactee category of shapely, attractive humans from other planets and don't fit into the sinister abduction phenomena that begins with Betty and Barney Hill. I think Antonio Villas-Boas case, I think you can fit that into any number of categories, but where it fits for me is in this sort of intermediate period. And a great resource for this is Alberto Rosales runs the humanoid a website about humanoid categorization, categories of humanoids and contact stories. But also, where I got my first introduction to all that was Jim and Coral Lorenzen's book from the late 60s, Flying Saucer Occupants, where they actually, in the back, after telling all these stories, have a chart of how many different kinds of encounters there were with different types of flying saucer occupants. Everything ranging from hairy dwarves to human-looking people to different types of robots. So throughout the 1950s and 60s, there was a lot of diversity in the type of alleged space aliens that people were meeting with. And then the Betty and Barney Hill thing happens. You have the book Interrupted Journey, John Fuller's book that comes out about their story. Crucially, you have the TV movie. And then in the 1980s, you start to get the Bud Hopkins and John Mack sort of trend of researching these things. And that sort of takes over in the popular culture. I'm not sure why it happened, as I finally get around to answering your question.
Okay.
I'm not sure why it happened, but what's clear is that it wasn't as much a turning point from contactees to abductees as it is that these two categories are on opposite ends of what seems to be a very sort of shallow curve that we're turning. It's not a turning point. It's more a curve we're going around so gradually that we don't really realize it's something different until we realize that,
yeah, okay,
well, this is very different. So I'm not sure how noticeable it was to people living it at the time. If you look back at, like, the NICAP newsletters and the magazines of the time, what you see is initially a lot of skepticism of these abductee claims, a lot of connecting them to the old contactee stuff and dismissing them that way, and you get a sort of gradual acceptance as more and more of these stories come out. So it's a longer process than it looks from our 21st century vantage point, I think.
Yeah, we have the benefit of hindsight to see that it's changing.
Yeah.
With the benefit of hindsight, you know, it's kind of remarkable to look back and see the change from this friendly presence to then all of a sudden everybody's all concerned and fearful of ETs. It's an odd sort of thing. You wonder, again, it goes back to the idea of, like, first impressions, and I'm fascinated, I guess, by the public perception of all this, and that's an interesting sort of way things changed.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's become so, the world has become so fragmented that it's hard to really get a gauge on what people believe as far as all this stuff goes, too.
Yeah, and belief is a tricky word and a tricky concept, you know, to begin with. And then you throw in the fact that nobody, very few people, if you say flying saucers or UFOs, everybody has a different idea of what that even means.
Right, right.
And it's so informed by the popular culture, and the popular culture is then in turn informed by, you know, the theories and ideas that are out there, that it's hard to tell where one begins and another ends. It's something that I've given up trying to explain and am content just to study.
Explain what it all means, you mean?
Explain what it all means, explain exactly where the dividing line is between what is actually there and what is simply the sort of pop cultural manifestation of what might be there, or an interpretation. And of course, trying to figure out what it all means. It's not something I feel qualified to do at this point, and so I'll keep talking and writing about the culture surrounding the phenomenon. But to get more deeply into that is like you termed it, it's a rabbit hole that I'm not sure I want to go much further down, just for my own sense of sanity and you know, actually having to function, you know, as a working human being with a regular job and a family and everything. So it's a tough thing. I have a strange and almost pitying admiration for the few actual full-time paranormal investigators out there. It's a cruel mistress to sort of slave your life to, because I'm not sure if there's any significant hope that you're going to get any sort of resolution. At least religious belief has some sort of afterlife for the faithful. I'm not sure what ufology offers.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, I always advise people, have a plan B. Learn a trade before you become a UFO
learn a trade.
Researcher. Because
that's what I tell students who want to be history majors, too. You know? Learn a trade. You know, do auto maintenance. The money's in fixing cars, kids, you know?
Exactly, exactly. Now, you teased what's next for you, I think, because we're up to 2 hours now, and
I've actually got to get going. Yeah.
I know.
Soon.
I know.
Yeah.
But I feel like I already know that you're going to be sort of joining the fold here of frequent guests.
Well, that's awesome because this is fun.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, this is an amazing conversation. Like, we could go for like another 3 hours and probably not even realize.
I know.
It.
As far as what's next for me,
yes.
I mentioned a book I'm writing, just sort of signed the contracts a couple of weeks ago on it, for Roman and Littlefield, which is an academic publisher, mostly of humanities and social science stuff, for their series on science fiction television about the intersection of conspiracy theory and the paranormal, how that culture impacted and was impacted by the science fiction TV of the 90s. So everything from the X-Files, to conspiracy theory and paranormal and paranoia type stuff popping up in other science fiction shows. It sort of appeared everywhere. You're watching Star Trek, and suddenly you have this new Deep Space Nine show where you have Section 31, which is almost pulled out of somebody's Usenet post about what the extra governmental cabal might be up to, right? So you have all these little strands pulled from the culture. So it's not so much a book about the paranormal as about the pop culture side of things, and that is that's going to be occupying most of my writing time during this year. I'm going to be writing it over the course of 2014. I'm going to probably continue blogging at ajgullius.com, hopefully doing that a bit more. I sort of slacked off while I was writing other stuff. You know, you get done writing a chapter of a book and you really don't want to post something to a website, because
right.
It's either going to give away something you just wrote for the book, or it's going to be a post like, I just wrote, you know, 5,000 words and I'm going to go have a beer now, you know, which yeah. You know, doesn't really do a lot for people. And you know, Facebook, we have Facebook for that, but I'm hopefully going to be blogging a bit more, but this giant book about the sci-fi stuff in the 90s is the big project, and hopefully some more podcast stuff.
Nice.
It's fun and doesn't take up a huge amount of time.
Awesome. Like I said, we definitely want to have you back on the show, because we could talk for quite a while, and I'd
be very
cool with that. I really like your detached perspective on all this. Like I said, we're sort of kinfolk in that way, as people
yeah.
who look at this from a very different perspective on all this, and try not to get so deep into it that you're up to your neck in suppositions that you have to keep. You know, spinning plates. It's a very
right,
I've mixed
yeah.
like eight metaphors there, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah, we've staked our reputations and our work on the way we observe it, not the answers we've come up with or the theories we have.
Exactly,
which is I think a much I mean cynically I can say it's a much safer way to do it, but it's also I think much more useful in a lot of ways. You know, because every field needs its commentators.
There you
go.
I
think that's the role a lot of other podcast hosts do, is you're not journalists per se, but you're commentators on the culture and facilitating conversations, which is important.
Well, I think this was a great conversation, Aaron. I can't thank you enough
yeah.
for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me on.
That does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 8. Big, big thanks to Aaron Gullius for coming on the show and for giving us so much time. Be sure to stop by his website, www.ajgullius.com, and that is spelled ajgullias.com. And go out and get your hands on a copy of The Chaos Conundrum, Essays on UFOs, Ghosts, and Other High Strangeness in Our Non-Rational and Atemporal World, from Red Star Books. Be sure to check it out. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback, and we're going to limit it to just two emails here this week, because I want to get the episode out to folks as soon as possible. And we got two emails here that reference some deep cuts in the BOA audio archive, which I really do appreciate. So let's dive on in. The first one comes from Steve in Ohio, and here's what he has to say. In case you didn't know, I found the Kentroversy tapes on iTunes. These were done by a former BOA audio guest, the late Kent Daniel Bentkowski. He was a great guest. Steve in Ohio. Thank you very much for writing in, Steve, and thank you for the heads up regarding the Kentroversy tapes. I actually had to dig into the BOA audio archive myself here to try and remember when we had the late Kent Daniel Bentkowski on BOA audio, and stunningly, it was all the way back in season 2, which is quite a long time ago. Let me take a look here and see what the date is on that episode we posted. May 12th, 2007, so almost 7 years ago that we had the late Kent Daniel Bentkowski on the program. He obviously subsequently passed away a few years later, and I can't recall the conversation as well as I would like, but I do remember that I enjoyed it quite a bit and delved into a whole bunch of interesting conspiracy topics, looking at the esoteric underpinnings of popular movies and conspiracies revolving around microchips and Hillary Clinton. Daniel Benkowski definitely had a very unique slant on things and a very compelling perspective on the world of conspiracy theory, and he is definitely missed. So folks should definitely punch in the Kentroversy tapes on iTunes and check out some classic programs from a former BOA Audio guest who is no longer with us, the late Kent Daniel Benkowski. Thank you once again, Steve, for bringing this to our attention, and I highly recommend the BOA Audio listeners go out and check out the Kentroversy tapes. Next email comes from Michael in Minnesota. Here's what he has to say. Just re-listening to your BOA Audio interview with R. Gary Patterson. You asked him about Rush conspiracies. This might not have been well known at the time, but look up Solaris Blue Raven. She claimed to have been electronically harassed by Neil Peart via voice-to-skull technology. You can hear her Saturday night talk show on freedomslips.com. Michael in Minnesota. Very fascinating stuff. I'm going to have to look into this one, Michael. Solaris Blue Raven saying she was electronically harassed by Neil Peart via voice-to-skull technology. Only in the esoteric, my friends, can you hear stories like this. So I will definitely look into that one. Thank you for bringing it to our attention, Michael in Minnesota. Another reference to a deep cut episode from the BOA Audio Archive. R. Gary Patterson appeared on the program way back on BOA Audio Season 5. Definitely somebody I'd like to get back on the program in the future to talk about paranormal and conspiracy related elements surrounding the world of pop music. And that does it for BOA Audio listener feedback. As I said, we were going to do a short and to the point installment of the segment here on the program this week, and I think we did. Thanks to Steve in Ohio for writing in. Thanks to Michael in Minnesota for his email as well. If you'd like to reach out to me for future installments of BOA Audio Listener Feedback, there are a number of ways to do so. You can write to Banal at banalofamerica.com or just go to banalofamerica.com and click the contact button. If you want to use the old school method of reaching out to me, just write to boaaudio@hotmail.com. That will also reach me. Or join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. It is BOA's paranormal playground, where we discuss the world of pop culture and the paranormal with a small circle of friends, but we're always looking for newcomers to join in on the fun. If you don't want to try and scribble down all those letters, just head on over to Banal of America and click the forum button. Additionally, I am on Facebook and Twitter, so just search out Banal, B-I-N-N-A-L-L. That will bring up my respective profiles on those sites. Feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good, and I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. And finally, please allow me to plug Banal of America on Facebook. That is where you're going to get the most breaking news about what's happening at BOA. That's kind of where we keep our in-house notes. So if you want to know what's going on with Banal of America, why the next episode you've been waiting for still has not appeared at BOA, chances are you're going to get your answer at Banal of America on Facebook, or just ask me on there and I'd be happy to answer you. As you can imagine, it is Facebook and it is very interactive. So just punch in Banal of America on Facebook and like us. Up next, it's time to take a moment and thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, our webmaster Ray Weigel, and our graphics guru, Jeremy Boston. considering that I can hear the snow melting outside and I know that spring is on its way. Perhaps it's time for a little spring cleaning of sorts, a little call to arms at Banal of America, and opening up the gates here at BOA for potential new writers at the website. I'd like to bring in some fresh voices here to help us usher in the springtime. So to all those hardcore BOA audio listeners out there right now who are listening to the show, do you have something to say about the esoteric and the paranormal? Would you like to write for BOA? Reach out to me, get in touch, let me know what you have to say, let me know what you might want to write about for Banal of America, because we are definitely looking for some new writers at BOA. I got to get on the stick and get in touch with Bruce Rux and hopefully bring him into the mix here at Banal of America. But beyond that, I want some additional writers at BOA, some fresh new voices would be fantastic. So I'm turning it over here to the hardcore BOA audio listeners. I know you're out there. I know you have something to say about the esoteric. As I said, get in touch with me, and I'd be happy to talk to you about coming on board at Banal of America. Now comes the time in the program where I take my hat off and pass it around to the BOA audio listeners and ask you to make a donation to the BOA franchise. How do you do that? That is simple. Head on over to banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com, and click the PayPal button. That'll take you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe, secure, and simple. But if you don't trust the internet and you'd like to make a donation, you can do so via sending your donation to our snail mail address. That you can find at Banal of America next to the PayPal button. If you do mail us a donation, please make it payable to Tim Banal and not Banal of America, because my bank is anal and they will not allow me to cash those checks. And please include some form of correspondence so I can reach out to you and thank you for your donation. As always, I say it at the end of the show when we make the call for donations, but it bears repeating, my friends, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. On the next edition of BOA Audio, I've got a couple of different irons in the fire, so it's hard for me right now to tell you what you'll be hearing on the program next. I just scheduled another live edition of the program, which will be coming at you on Saturday, March 22nd, with a couple of good friends of the show who have yet to appear on Banal of America. I'm going to have more details about that in the next few days. But until then, I need to make a decision of sorts. I'm going to have a crazy work week that actually starts tomorrow. It's going to keep me tied up for about 6 or 7 days. So if there's an opportunity to do a program in the interim, we will definitely try and do so. I can't tell you for sure that is the case, as I said, because my work week is about to get very, very crazy. But I'm looking at my schedule right now, and I've got a couple of open days before the 22nd. So if I can do so, maybe I'll jam another installment of the show in there so we don't have folks waiting too long between episodes. Stay tuned to Banal of America and BOA on Facebook for further details. Worst case scenario, you got to wait 11 days for the next edition of the program. But on the bright side, by the 22nd, my schedule will have cleared up quite a bit. And in the week following that, I've got 3 programs scheduled to be taped. So the back catalog will begin really filling up after that. And hopefully, we'll be able to get back on a weekly schedule for all of you great folks out there. As I said, stay tuned to Banal of America and BOA on Facebook for further details. And with all that said, we close the book on this edition of the program. Once again, big, big thanks to Aaron Gullius for coming on the show. Check out the Chaos Conundrum, folks. And big thanks to Steve in Ohio, as well as Michael in Minnesota, for their contributions to BOA Audio Listener Feedback. Finally, of course, enormous thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA audio listeners, the ones who stick around to the very end and listen to my ramblings here at the end of the show. Thank you for your enduring support of the program. You are the fuel that drives the mothership of paranormal entertainment that is Banal of America. Thank you once again for making BOA audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.